You know what? Get over it, because we've got a country to run, and that's what I've demanded of them.
I wish ScoMo and Joshy every success.
Government members do not trust each other.
I'm a bit lost for words. That doesn't happen very often.
The wrap.
It's the end of the week. Time to wrap up some of the big news stories of the week. And we're also at the end of week two of the federal election campaign. With me to do all of that is Karen Middleton, Chief Political Correspondent for the Saturday paper, and Bhakti Puvanantharan, who's Managing Editor at Crikey News. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, PK.
So, Clive Palmer's having another go at politics, spending big on campaign ads for his newly formed United Australia Party. Karen, how far do you reckon he's going to get this time?
Well, it looks like further than we might have expected, actually. Patricia, we all will remember, well, anyone who's had their eyes open for the last, I don't know, it seems like 12 months, will have seen Clive Palmer's yellow billboards and television ads bombarding us perpetually, and it seems like it might have been working, because at least the latest polling from the seat of Herbert suggesting he in Queensland is suggesting he could be polling as high as 14%. Now, that's a single seat poll, so they are notoriously unreliable, but it is an indicator that maybe people are responding to his advertisements, and that there's a high recognition factor, and that he may well be pivotal. He's running candidates, I think, in every seat, well, pretty close to it. He's certainly running candidates in seats that the coalition needs to hang on to and is struggling in. And I think particularly in some of those central Queensland seats where you saw at the Queensland state election in the equivalent state seats a very high One Nation vote, the United Australia Party vote there could also be reasonably substantial, and that might help the coalition out if they do a preference deal.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison once described Clive Palmer as a circus sideshow, and Mr. Palmer compared Mr. Morrison to a Nazi. I kid you not, these things have been said. Yes, they've really been said. A reporter asked the Prime Minister about this earlier this week. Have a listen.
This is a man who left Queensland nickel workers in the lurch, compared you to Heinrich Himmler. You can't possibly preference him with that record, can you?
Well, I did see some comments he made about an approach when we made a criticism some years ago. Look, I'm not going to be held back by that, nor am I here to offer any defences of Mr. Palmer. He's big enough to do that for himself.
Bhakti, a deal, even though lots of not very nice words have been spoken.
Yeah, I mean, Clive Palmer, let's not forget, I said this earlier in the week, had the worst attendance record when he was the member for Fairfax, and the worst voting record. He's just never there, and he wasn't at his electorate office either. So the idea that this, even if they're successful in getting the election, that they can then be a sustainable, lasting part of Australian politics is a whole other ball game. But it's not just the seat-by-seat polling. I think the Australia Institute had Senate polling, which would obviously be bigger, and they say in Victoria, of all places, they're on 4.7%. Mm. So it's potentially that Victoria, you know, likely that Victoria, which had the biggest, leftward swing of all the states in recent years, is now potentially going to get a UOP senator. I went and looked at their YouTube videos.
How did that go for you?
You know, it was standard stuff, but there was one that had hundreds of thousands of views, and it was the policy for $150 of extra pension per week. Extra per week for pensioners. And, you know, there wasn't much in the budget for pensioners, and clearly he's figured out that that's an area that he can target where lots of people are dissatisfied. There are other policies that he's, you know, put out as well that are populist, for, you know, want of a better word. He doesn't have to do any costings around this stuff. He can just throw around numbers and you know, seemingly have some success.
Now, the Liberal Party's former Premier in Western Australia, Colin Barnett, has cautioned against this deal. Let's hear what he says.
Many Liberal supporters, perhaps soft or swinging supporters, will react adversely to any sort of deal with Palmer. And the consequence could be that maybe in some country areas, the Liberal Party may hold on to some seats, but in other areas, particularly metropolitan cities, there is the danger of a backlash.
What did you make of that, Karen?
Well, I think he's warning that just as some in the Liberal Party warn about doing deals with One Nation, he's warning that there may be a positive on one side of the ledger and a negative on the other, and that in some parts of the country it might go well in certain seats where there's a substantial enough percentage of primary votes going to the United Australia Party that it will help get Liberals or Nationals across the line, but in other places they'll be angry because there was kind of chaos when Clive Palmer was in the Senate and we saw people leaving his party. You know, it wasn't a stable period in the Senate, and what Bhakti says is right. His attendance record in the House was pretty appalling. So there'll be people in the Liberal Party who think this is a very bad idea to try and to win off the back of encouraging this kind of person who's also not paid proper wages, back pay to the nickel workers in Queensland. And so he's got a questionable industrial record, and he's got close links to China as well, and not entirely positive links in the past. So there's a sort of multi-layered argument against it, but there'll be others who say, well, if it helps us win, we'll do it. And that seems to be the sentiment that's prevailing.
And isn't it true that there are ASIC charges that remain against him, potentially criminal ASIC charges? That's my understanding.
It's going to be very interesting, though. Well, how much, just final comment before we move on to another story, does it say, though, about how Australians are kind of disenfranchised with the major parties, that they are willing to park with a guy who's got, like, very yellow billboards?
Here's what I think. He's had a lot, he's been able to spend a lot of money. It feels like it's been a year of these billboards and TV ads. He says relatively palatable populist things in them, and he's been able to pay for cut through. I don't know if that says anything about the other parties.
So, Karen, let's get to your big story. And you've been observing, very rightly, it's very interesting, that the two major parties have been campaigning. There is a national campaign and there's a very localised campaign. Who's running what?
Well, it's interesting. I think, yes, we in some elections we see the campaign being run sort of mostly as a national campaign with national messaging, because there's a feeling that there might be a national swing, or that there are big issues that are prevailing that are going to swing people's votes. But I get the sense in this election, and I think I saw my Parliament House colleague David Crowe writing such things this morning as well in Fairfax papers, that there is a very localised campaign, seat by seat, being run, and you're seeing particularly the Prime Minister ducking from seat to seat to seat, and spending a lot of time in Tasmania. They both are spending a lot of time in Tasmania, where there are several seats on pretty narrow margins, and you do get the sense that there is a very localised campaign being run on the ground. There's a lot of money that was squirreled away in the budget under that line, that ubiquitous line, decisions made but not yet announced, and we're seeing handfuls of money being targeted at particular seats or on issues that are going to resonate in particular seats, like money for veterans recently. And, of course, the seat of Herbert in Queensland, around Townsville, has a lot of veterans, so, and a lot of military voters there. So, you know, there is a sense that there is a sort of very localised campaign being run, as well as the national messaging from the government on the economy and managing the economy, and from the opposition on fairness and those kinds of principles.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Bhakti. I mean, I was observing just before that... The coalition's campaign is, we're not Labor, steady as she goes. They've got their big tax plan, but beyond that, it's very small, localised announcements. There is no huge narrative. And with Labor, it's a pretty high-risk strategy, because there's a lot of policy, but it's contentious.
And it's been out for a while, so people are able to pick it apart. I was reading today about Jason Wood, the Liberal who holds the seat of La Trobe, and he's been targeting the youth vote. I'm sure we all heard that the electoral roll's up and there are more young people enrolled than ever before. And so he was targeting young people on, you know, social media platforms with ads about how they're going to fund 30 new headspace, like youth mental health facilities. You're right, it's very fragmented, and it really reflects as well, I think, social media and how campaigns are run now, which is demographic by demographic, location by location. You know, I was talking to someone yesterday, lives in Geelong, and they just want to see fast rail. Like, that's what's going to decide their vote. So in some ways, yes, Labor's been polling ahead for years, but maybe that doesn't matter.
Mm. What do you think, Karen? Does it matter?
Well, the data collection capacities are so good now that they can get very precise sort of breakdowns of who lives where and what they care about. And you can also target advertisements on social media much better. You don't have to run a television ad across, you know, an entire region. You can target ads to individuals virtually on social media at a much lower cost. So that does enable all of this. And Bhakti might be right that we may well see these national polls suggesting one thing, but that in little pockets there'll be particular issues that people care about that may well sway things, and we may not in the end see a national swing. We may still see a national swing. We've seen, 50-something polls going for the Labor Party, but I think there'll be, the way this campaign is playing out, it looks like there'll be particular issues and factors in individual seats that might make them closer than we might have expected.
Fascinating stuff. If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvalis. We're wrapping up the week with my two guests, Karen Middleton, who's the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent, and Bhakti Puvanantharan, who's managing editor at Crikey News. Bhakti, let's talk about your story. One thing we haven't really heard the politicians talking much about this week is cybersecurity and data protection, except voter data's a huge gold mine for political campaigns pretty much everywhere, right?
Yeah, that's right. So when the Privacy Act came in the 90s, political parties were exempt conveniently from that. So that means that the Labor Party, the Liberal Party, all the parties have information on your age, your location, occupation, who you live with, your phone number, anything publicly available about you, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, anything that you might have put out, or how you responded to a door knock, how you responded to a robocall, all of that stuff is out there, and we have no guarantees that that information is not being hacked. We know that there was a cybersecurity breach on Parliament last year. We know that our politicians aren't necessarily as savvy about cybersecurity as we would want them to be. And I think it's a bit terrifying when you see what's happened with elections being rigged overseas.
Where does the law stand on all of this? I mean, you've mentioned the Privacy Act, but it doesn't offer that much protection, really, does it?
No, not when it comes to political parties. So what they argue, and what Christian Porter argues, as well as his Labor counterparts, is that this is about freedom of political communication. If they have all this data on you, then they can communicate better to you. What he really means is that they can better win your vote. And, it works in both every party's favour to have that information. So it seems like one where who's going to represent the people's interests in Parliament? I don't know.
I know you've been covering politics for a long time, Karen. I say that as a compliment.
Thanks.
Or I want to give you a hug.
Feels like a long time around about now. Yeah.
They've always been doing this data mining, though. This is what they've built databases. This is not new, is it?
No, the building of databases is certainly not new, and the keeping of information, but I think they have tools that allow them, as I said before, they allow them to do it more precisely now and to hold more and more information and use it in different ways. And the question is that information being protected? And I think we have seen a bit of a cavalier attitude to privacy on some information emerging through the debate in Parliament, debates in Parliament about some national security legislation. And I know when I was writing about the changes to security legislation, I was surprised to find how much sort of sidestepping of the Privacy Act there actually is, even when it does apply. There's a lot more cross-matching of information within government and loopholes that allow the Privacy Act to be sidestepped than before. And I do think there's a general attitude that we'll find reasons, ways to do things when we've got a good reason to use the information. And the question is whether that information, in the case of political parties, is being stored well enough and protected well enough, or whether it's at risk of being hacked.
And when we know that they are a target, an international target for that information. And not just that, there was a story yesterday in the ABC about the Australian taxation, I've now forgotten the name of it, but it's an app that
Taxpayers Association,
who have put out an app that kind of gamifies getting their message out there, and their messages stop short. It could be, I guess it's technology that's available to other political groups as well. But what it does, and it can do, is take your phone, the context off your phone. So, you know, voters are targets, political parties are targets, and the protections just aren't there.
All right, Karen, let's have this debate about debates. Every single election campaign, we have what I'm sure voters find as incredibly tedious, a debate about the debates. So, lay of the land, we've got two debates next week, but they're not on prime time of free-to-air TV, right?
No, and they're targeting, well, they're associated with particular networks. So instead of having a national debate that can be screened right across the networks if they wish to take it, as we've seen in years past, we had one or two major debates between the two leaders of the major parties and all the networks would carry it, or various networks. And then we increasingly got into the rivalry between networks. Now we're going to see a Perth-based debate on Monday, hosted by the West Australian newspaper and the Seven Network, and then we'll see another debate on Friday hosted by Sky News. Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, has been goading Bill Shorten, the opposition leader, and saying, come on, I'm happy to have many more debates. What are you afraid of? This kind of thing. Bill Shorten has come out today and say he's happy to have a third debate. It's not clear whether that would be with the Nine Network or the ABC, but he is saying he's happy to have it. But I think
Can I just clarify? I've got the letter, and in it he says he wants it at the National Press Club, and he wants a representative from the ABC and one from Nine because they've been battling it out. But already there's a response from the coalition. This is literally just, you know, I like to tell people how it actually happens because I think people don't realise just how counterclaim and claim. Already the coalition has released a statement just now, it's in my inbox, saying Bill Shorten will clearly do anything to avoid prime time scrutiny. So the issue now is around the time of that debate.
Yes, well, I think what is going on is the coalition is taking the opportunity to try and drag Bill Shorten into the spotlight, because one of their weapons in this election is the fact that he's not very popular. And I think they think if they can either point out that Bill Shorten is trying to hide from scrutiny, or if they can allege that, or if they can drag him into the spotlight and have people listen to him and look at him as much as possible, that they think that that might go well for them. So I think that's the underlying issue in this back and forth about the debates, that the coalition thinks that the more they talk about either him refusing to have debates or getting him involved in debates, that they think that their bloke will do better than this other bloke.
Bhakti, have you debated out over the debates?
You know what's funny to me about it is that both leaders, both parties, senior ministers in all parties avoid the media that they want to avoid. They do it all the time. Mm. And so this idea that one side is worse at it than the other is such a furphy. Cracky ran a story last week about how, you know, which ministers front up to Q&A more often. And it's far more on the coalition side that decide, oh, no thanks, not for me, including Scott Morrison, who I believe hasn't been on the show for years. So this idea that, you know, one is a more forthright side, it's just not true.
I have to say, PK, too, I suspect that an awful lot of voters would rather put hot pokers in their eyes than watch a debate between these two leaders on any network at any time.
I think that's right. But look, some people like to watch it, so it still should be available. And I do think prime time is important.
I do agree.
Yeah. I think you're right, though. I absolutely agree with you. Goodness gracious. We're paid to watch it and it's hurting. All right. Boom. Sorry I had to say that. Now, we always ask our guests for recommendations for what we should be doing on the weekend. What should we be doing on the weekend?
Me?
Yeah, you!
Righto. Well, I have a film recommendation for everyone. The film is called Top End Wedding. It's a gorgeous comedy, romantic comedy, if you like, set in our very own Top End, starring the gorgeous Miranda Tapsell and a Brit named Gwilym Lee, directed by Wayne Blair. You know, it's about family. It's about a road trip. There's gorgeous scenery and gorgeous music. And I'm not sure if it's out this weekend. It is out now, actually.
Good, because so I want to see it too.
Get into it. Yeah. We all need a bit of light relief, I think.
Ah, we do. Karen Middleton, have you got something light for me?
Oh, I don't know if it's light.
No, you don't.
I've been getting into a podcast. It's been around for a little while. It's by Malcolm Gladwell, the journalist for The New Yorker, who's a Canadian journalist originally. And he wrote the fantastic book, The Tipping Point, and a number of others since. And he's got a podcast called Revisionist History, and he describes it as it's about being things that were overlooked and misunderstood. And it's a fantastically produced podcast that takes kind of examples from recent and past history and explores sort of big ideas, big issues, why things happen, myths, misunderstandings, and it's really good. I recommend it. It's fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you to both of you for coming in. It's been very fun.